We've just endured a polar vortex with record low temperatures in some places, but what does that mean for plants and insects this spring? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. We'll start the hour with an insect update. It would be nice to think this extreme cold is a setback for some of our least favorite invasive insects. Entomologist Donald Lewis will share his thoughts on the matter. Then on to plants. Horticulturists Richard Duran and Chris Curry will be here. We'll talk about how the deep freeze might affect some of the plants in our landscape. And then we'll think warmer thoughts and talk about raising orchids in our climate-controlled homes. Chris and Richard will also answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we've just gotten through what we hope is the worst that the winter of 2019 has to offer. So what does that mean for when things start to warm up? In a few minutes, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Duran and Chris Curry, associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State, will be here to talk plants. We're also going to talk about growing orchids this hour, but we're going to start the hour with insects. Iowa State University professor of entomology Donald Lewis is on the line with us from California. Hi, Donald.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you for being here. It was a good idea to spend the month of January in California, so well done to you.
Yes, I got to miss the worst of the cold and got to do one of the most important jobs I could. We're out here helping take care of our granddaughter.
Nice. So nice. Now that we've been through this polar vortex, I am already seeing blog posts and people speculating about what this deep, intense cold might mean for some of the invasive insects that we battle all the time. I saw a blog post out of Minnesota speculating that maybe this will knock the emerald ash borer back. So, what do you think?
I think there's a lot of wishful thinking when we try to find lemonade when nature gives us lemons. Every year, insects die over the winter. And that's to be expected. Our populations of insects are always lower in the spring than they were the previous fall. And for some insects, it's a very, very steep drop from the fall population to the spring. Things like yellow jackets and bumblebees may lose 99% of the population over the winter, but they start over the following year. So it happens. There will be fewer insects in the spring than there were in the fall. But does it make a big difference? Probably not.
All right. So this is part of the natural cycle. It's just been a little colder than normal, is what I'm hearing you're saying.
Right. It's natural to have this occur. But insects that live in freezing temperatures are adapted to survive those temperatures. But if every insect died over winter, it would be paradise, wouldn't it? But they don't. They have mechanisms for surviving. They produce an antifreeze in their body that prevents ice from forming. And that antifreeze then protects them from most of the freezing temperatures. But there are low enough temperatures, especially for some of our more southern insects, that will kill a majority of the population. But insects are adapted to survive. They're better suited for this climate than we are. And the emerald ash borer may suffer some setbacks, but it will not be gone.
I remember having this exact same conversation with you back in 2013, the last time we had one of these polar vortex events. And I also remember that the summer of 2013, Japanese beetles, another one of our favorite invasive insects, were less prevalent. It really did seem to knock them back. Am I remembering right?
Yes, And in the fall of 2013, after the population had been so high, we had a very dry fall that year. And so the Japanese beetles were low on moisture. The Japanese beetle grubs that are 4 to 6 inches deep in the ground were low on moisture. And that winter of 2013-2014, the freeze in the soil was deeper and longer lasting than usual. And when we came into the summer of 2014, it seemed like the Japanese beetle population was lower. There were fewer calls, there were fewer complaints. People had fewer Japanese beetles on their roses and ornamental trees. But if you'll recall, by 2017, we were right back up to outbreaks of Japanese beetle. So these temporary drops in population happen, but insects have the ability to recover. And for the Japanese beetle, every female that survived the winter was able to produce 40 to 60 eggs the following year. And you can see populations would multiply very quickly from just a few survivors.
Right. And of course, this past summer, we talked about Japanese beetles being pretty much everywhere again. So it is possible, just to squeeze a little bit of lemonade out of this, it is possible that we might get a little bit of a respite this summer?
If anything, the spread of the emerald ash borer may be slowed. But when we think about emerald ash borer living and surviving in Manitoba, Canada, Ontario, Quebec, Canada. The city of St. Paul last year spent $1 million removing and replacing and treating trees for emerald ash borer, and this year they plan to spend $2.5 million. The emerald ash borer is doing well further north than us. So if we get any effect of the cold weather, it may be a slowing of the natural spread, but these freezes will not eliminate emerald ash borer.
All right. Well, Donald Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's always a pleasure, Charity. Thank you for calling.
Iowa State University Professor of Entomology Donald Lewis joining us today from California. And now back in Iowa, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Geron is here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Chris Curry, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Chris.
Morning, Charity.
And it's warming up a little bit out there today.
It's positive one.
Right. So above zero. This is a major step forward. So, all right, we were talking about insects. Let's talk about plants, because every time we have a bitterly cold winter, we do lose some of the plants in our landscape. What does this mean, or what can we expect this spring, Richard?
Well, first of all, woody plants develop cold hardiness gradually in the fall. And so by midwinter, they're at their maximum peak as far as cold hardiness. So the cold occurred at the right time of year. If it had occurred earlier, let's say in early December, it would have been far more destructive. But late January, okay. So as far as your native plants, they're adapted to our climate, so they should be fine. Or plants that are native to similar areas in the world as far as the climate, they should be fine. But then you have those plants that are marginally hardy that we've been planting over the last maybe 10 to 15 years. Things like, for example, Japanese maple, flowering cherries. Those are kind of marginally hardy in this area. And when it gets down to minus 25, minus 30, that may be too much for them. So you might expect to see maybe some dieback. In some cases, maybe total death on some plants.
All right. And this winter was unusually mild leading up to the part where it got to be unusually severe. Is that a concern?
I don't think so much in that regard. We did get some colder temperatures beginning around early January, so it wasn't that sudden. Now, another thing we might see on even native trees would be what they call frost cracks, like on sycamore, oaks, maples, where it gets so cold that the wood contracts and it actually pops, and you have this vertical crack on the trunk. So you may see those on certain trees like sycamore, oaks, and maples.
Yeah, we had a listener send us a picture yesterday. Jeff sent us a picture of his oak tree with a long vertical crack in it, and he was able to stick a ruler into the crack. It goes 8 inches deep into the tree. What does that mean for his oak tree?
Well, that crack may never heal over or fill back in, so it's going to be a wound that could eventually lead to maybe a root rot because it's basically open, exposed. So that is a potential concern. But it's not a short-term problem as far as the tree will survive for quite some time, but eventually you may get a root rot there, or excuse me, a wood rot.
Okay. And it's an impressive crack. So have you heard that this is happening widely?
No, but it does occur occasionally. Typically on trees that are more in an open exposed site, and usually more on the south or west side, where on a very cold sunny day, the side exposed to the sun might be a little bit warmer. And then at sunset, the temperatures drop very, very quickly, and the wood contracts very quickly, and it may pop and form a crack.
All right. Is there anything that somebody should do if that happens to one of their trees?
Boy, you really can't do much of anything.
Stick a ruler in it and share pictures, right?
But trying to fill the crack or painting it doesn't really do any good in the spring, so you basically just let the tree deal with the injury by itself.
All right. Now, in the spring, when things leaf out, how long do we wait to see if, you know, things are lagging a little bit, if they're going to be okay?
Right. As far as trees and shrubs, hopefully they're leafing out by early May, late April, early May. If you see very few leaves by mid to late May, there's a problem there. Now, there may be some plants, some shrubs that don't bloom this well very, very, very well this spring just because the flower buds aren't quite as cold hardy as the leaf buds. So, for example, flowering quince, some forsythia varieties, they may not bloom this spring, but they probably should leaf out normally.
Now, again, we had that mild spell leading up to January, and some people were already starting to say, hey, I am seeing my plants respond as if it's spring right now. Does that compromise what we could see with blooms in the spring?
I don't think most woody plants are doing that. I think some people go out and they see the buds, but the buds have been there since late summer. And they're basically pretty tight at this point and dormant, so they probably should be okay. So they didn't really see anything previously in the winter. So I wouldn't worry about that.
All right. So right now, what we need to be doing is just looking at our garden catalogs and dreaming of spring. There's nothing we can actually be doing right now.
Well, there's one thing you might be doing is you might want to go out and check your trees and shrubs, especially the younger ones. As far as with the cold temperatures, the snow cover, the rabbits and mice are very, very under stress.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to look for food. And a young tree or a shrub, they will eat the bark down to the wood. And if they do that, they can destroy or damage certain plants. So,
all right, so if you didn't protect them this fall, you may have a shot this weekend. It's going to warm up a little bit.
Right,
so
go out and check. And if necessary, put some fencing around them so they don't do that.
All right. Well, we are going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and Chris Curry is going to talk with us about growing orchids, something we can do in our climate-controlled homes, bring a little beauty inside. And, of course, Richard and Chris will be answering your questions. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran and Chris Curry, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about the plants and trees in your landscape. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran and Chris Curry, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And yes, we've been talking about the extreme cold, but let's turn our thoughts to warmer, prettier things. We're going to talk about orchids. They are beautiful. They are fragile. And Chris, you've recently had some new training on orchids, right?
Well, this past fall, I taught a class, an honor seminar on campus.
Nice.
And it's called Orchid Mania. And so what the goal with that class was is orchids are really a passion of mine, because when I graduated with my bachelor's degree from in horticulture from the University of Minnesota, I became a commercial orchid grower at a wholesale grower in Minnesota. That's like the definition of optimism, being a commercial orchid grower in Minnesota.
Yes.
You don't want to see the fuel bills that cost. So they're really a first love of mine. And through orchids, I discovered the wonderful world of plant physiology, and I was falling to sleep reading these books about orchid physiology, because they're old plants, they're fascinating plants, they're primitive plants, they're highly diverse and specialized. So it's really what brought me back into graduate school and got me on the path towards where I am now, being a faculty member, teaching greenhouse crop production. And so they're a captivating crop, because there's interesting things with respect to their etymology, so where the names came from, and the history with the orchid hunters and the different specialized pollination mechanisms. And so I wanted to try and provide an opportunity to share my evangelical outlook about plants, and more specifically orchids, with non-life scientist majors. And so that was an opportunity to put together Orchid Mania. And every week we started off with an orchid of the week that I'd bring up. I maintain a collection of around probably, I haven't counted because I don't want to know the number, but I maintain a collection in the greenhouse, and we'd bring up a flowering plant and talk about the history, the plants that were used to breed it, and all sorts of fun stuff. And then we'd just talk about everything from orchids and art to orchid physiology. And we ended the semester by taking miniature Phalaenopsis moth orchids and mounting them onto cedar bark slabs, so the students could have an orchid mounted on bark growing in their apartment.
Oh, very cool. And you moved south here to Iowa to grow orchids more easily? Or is that
Yeah, that's the joke, right? Moving down to the tropical south. Although I will say, you know, we talk about this mild winter. I'd like to say my heart went out to my fellow ice fishermen down here in Iowa. We're glad that we finally got ice now. it's been a neat experience kind of coming back to my passion of orchids and having a class where I can share that.
And it was right. And to share it with people who weren't already engaged. People
yeah.
who weren't necessarily already orchid experts.
Absolutely. In the first day of class, we're going around the room. You know, I like to know people's motives for coming to my courses. And I asked for people to share why they enrolled in the course. And there were a few people that said, well, I think plants are pretty boring. It just fit my schedule. And by the end of the semester, they were correcting themselves and not calling soil dirt. They called it substrate. Excellent students. And they got passionate about orchids, too, or at least saw a little bit more why they're unique.
All right. Well, let's talk about what makes orchids so fascinating to you and to so many others. Or where do they come from?
Everywhere. 6 out of the 7 continents have orchids, so they're really all over. And I have trudged through the bogs of northern Minnesota trying to find the native lady slippers. I have been in the cloud forests of Costa Rica finding epiphytes growing on trees. I've been in some wet tropical forests. So they're adapted to all climates, from perennials that would be going dormant in these kind of conditions that we have to tropical plants. So they're really all over.
And given that it's such a diverse group, what makes them all orchids? What's the defining characteristic?
It has to do with the floral physiology. So if there are a couple of unique things about an orchid, but if you were to look at an orchid, you cut it down the middle and you fold it over, it'll make a mirror image. Now, the difference would be if you were to take, say, a dandelion or a sunflower, and so I'm using something from the aster family, you can cut that in half and you can make it symmetrical in a bunch of different ways. But orchids, they only have that one pattern. So that's one unique thing. Then there are some other unique aspects of the physiology. They've got some unique floral structures where some of the petals have actually fused together. So 2 separate petals over time have fused to make one specialized petal called a labellum. They also have their pollen, which is very, very small and fine, arranged in two sticky balls of pollen, and they're called the pollinia. And usually it's two, but occasionally there's three. But it has these very specialized pollen mechanisms. And the reason they have that is because these sticky pollen balls will get stuck on the pollinator's back as they move from plant to plant. And what's really cool is when you think about the pollination mechanism, all plants are trying to reproduce and they need to be pollinated. But they're sentient, so they can't necessarily meet up in the forest, so to speak. And the mechanisms by which orchids have attracted pollinators range from where we're imitating their mate. So oftentimes, let's say there might be something like a euglossine bee, which is a common orchid pollinator, and the orchid may try to look like another euglossine bee to draw it in. Interestingly now, they're finding that it's not just necessarily for mating, but sometimes they're actually, insects are coming in to fight off the orchid, thinking that it's getting in its territory. Then we also have things like scent, where I was down in the Corcovado National Park in southern Costa Rica, and there's an orchid that only is scented in the middle of the night, and it smells like eucalyptus, and that's to draw in this nocturnal moth orchid. And I did get up in the middle of the night and found one in the forest to smell it, because I am that guy.
That's so fascinating to think about how evolution could lead to something, a specialization like that.
Yeah, and that's what's so unique. Some people get caught up in which plant family is bigger, whether it's the sunflower family or the orchid family. But I don't get caught up in that because I don't need to prove anything. But what I do like to point out is even if the sunflower family has more species in it, look at all the sunflower family flowers. They all look somewhat similar, you know, a Gerbera daisy and a sunflower and a black-eyed Susan, they're all relatively similar. But when you look at a lady slipper versus a moth orchid versus any other number of orchid, they're so unique and so highly specialized that's a really unique story to tell.
Absolutely. Well, and we have talked in great detail about poinsettias in the past and how that was a plant that was discovered by an enthusiastic botanist in nature and brought back and domesticated in many ways. So with orchids all over the world, there must be dozens of stories about the people who discovered a specific strain of orchid and brought it inside.
Yeah, the Victorian era is really kind of a highlight in horticulture in general, but specifically for the orchids, because you had lots of disposable income and people would have a gardener and a plant explorer that they would send out to hunt down new species of orchids, because that was a sign of affluence to have an orchid collection, especially when you were discovering new species. And it was very, very secretive. There's a really good example, an orchid called Paphiopedilum Rothschildianum. And when that plant was discovered, the botanist who discovered it purposefully gave misleading information as to its whereabouts so others could not access it. And so it was the early orchid collectors, it was shrouded in mystery and secret because you wanted to have the exclusive rights or the only one growing this orchid, so you wouldn't share information about how to grow a plant better. You know, right now we've got all sorts of great orchid societies and everyone comes together and shares information and the rising tide floats all the boats. But back earlier, everything was very secretive because you wanted to be the one with orchids. And so there's lots of stories of plant hunters, especially in tropical locales, going to find orchids. And they are filled with people who have gone into the wilds and never come back. And it's pretty dramatic for a horticultural topic, actually.
So when we go into the garden center or the grocery store and we see a collection of orchids, probably the Phalaenopsis orchid, are those orchids similar to the orchids that grow in the wild? Have they changed much as people have domesticated them?
Yeah, they have changed. I'll make a broad generalization and say that generally the wild species of orchids tend to be more challenging to cultivate than a hybrid. And that just comes from something we call hybrid vigor. So as you start to cross different species and make hybrids, generally the offspring have less finicky requirements and just generally grow more vigorously and grow better. And so those species or the plants that you're seeing in garden centers and grocery stores, those are going to be hybrid orchids that have been bred often. It's not just two species. It often comes from a line of other hybrids, but they're highly developed hybrids, and so they're generally much more amenable to cultivation. And orchids are a very long crop. The facility that I used to work at in Minnesota, it originally started as a facility that bred Miltoniopsis, the pansy orchids, and then Paphiopedilums, the Southeast Asian lady slipper orchids. And you would have to grow these from seed, and from seed to flower takes about 7 years.
Wow.
Well, that's a ridiculous proposition to ask any greenhouse grower, especially up in Minnesota, to heat their greenhouse for 7 years. Generally, we like to have crop times on the long end, maybe up to 8 months or so in the greenhouse. So these hybrids, they just generally grow much quicker. We can propagate them easily through tissue culture, where you take a little piece of the stem and you can make thousands of plantlets. So they're just much more amenable to commercial cultivation. And they're also much more amenable to consumers being successful growing them in the house.
It's nice. It's nice when you don't kill everything that you bring into the house.
Oh, absolutely. I used to be a species only kind of guy. I wanted to have the species, but they would always, it took so much time and care, and I've killed more plants than I want to admit. But now I grow hybrids just because I can't invest the time tending to each individual species. And it's fantastic because they grow great, and it's a lot of positive feedback.
Well, it's so interesting to think that they are so adapted to different environments all over the world, and some really difficult environments as well. Although they're such a beautiful, fragile looking flower.
That's the deceptive part.
All right.
When you think about a Phalaenopsis moth orchid, one of the reasons they're such a phenomenal houseplant is that if you buy one, and let's say you see this orchid, I like to select one where only one or two flowers is open and the rest of the flower buds are still closed. But those flowers can last for, up to 2 months. And so they have this very delicate, very exotic appearance, but they're actually very hardy plants. In fact, benign neglect can sometimes be one of the best things to get them into flower. If they're pampered, they might stay in a vegetative growth phase and not flower. So orchids are actually, they look very delicate. And, especially the epiphytic type where you see their roots coming out of the pot, they have this very exotic look, but they're very, very, very tough plants.
Tom has a question about native orchids in Iowa. First, he wants to know if lady slippers grow in Iowa.
Yes. I'm still learning my Iowa flora, so give me a little bit of latitude here, but I believe that we have a few types of lady slippers. One is going to be Cypripedium calceolus. And I don't know if it's which variety it is, but that's going to be the yellow lady slipper. Then I think there are also limited populations of Cypripedium reginae, the queen's lady slipper, which also happens to be the state flower of Minnesota, which is also the only state with an orchid for a state flower. That's great trivia. Ask what state has an orchid for a state flower, and they'll say Hawaii and Florida, and then you come back with saying it's Minnesota, and that's I think that's kind of fun.
That's something we can all keep in our back pocket.
We also have another species that I think it is Cypripedium candidum, and that is a whitish-colored lady slipper that you actually find in more prairie and open environments. So there may be more lady slippers, but I believe that we have at least those three in this state.
All right. And now you were talking about growing orchids inside. Again, they are adapted to these special environments outside. When you grow them, I mean, what kind of substrate do they grow on?
So there's the first thing when people say I want to grow orchids, I say, well, do you want to grow them in a garden or would you like to grow them in your house? Because if you want to grow them in your garden, then you want to look for those what we call temperate perennial orchids that act like a regular herbaceous perennial. So I think, Richard, you said you've got a lady slipper growing
yes.
in your yard.
Yeah.
And so those you would just grow like any other perennial in your yard. You may need to do some amendments to lower a pH or something, but it's basically like a perennial. And if you want to grow them indoors, then you're likely going to be growing the tropical type orchids. Tropical orchids are going to be different than terrestrial orchids or temperate orchids, because temperate orchids grow as terrestrial in the earth of Terra. So they grow in traditional soil. Now, when we grow tropical orchids, they're either going to be epiphytic or lithophytic. It means they're growing on other plants, or that's the epiphytic plants, or they're growing on rocks, and those would be the lithophytic plants. And so there's where you've got these roots that are basically out in the air. And so when you think about those environments, that's obviously not going to be a place like the north here. It's going to be in a tropical place. And it's where you're going to get mist or fog or daily rain coming through. But then it's also not going to stay saturated. So you often want something that is going to leave plenty of air movement around those roots because that's what they're adapted to. And you want to be able to, you don't want it to hold too much moisture. So you can really grow orchids in a variety of ways. One of the most common orchid mixes is something containing, say, coarse bark and coarse chunks of perlite, something that's very free-draining. You can also grow them mounted on slabs where you maybe just have a little bit of sphagnum moss and you wrap it around the roots, and then you just hang it on your wall. You can also grow it in straight sphagnum moss in a container. I use a specialized technique called semi-hydroponic production. And if you can imagine, the containers that come when you get some takeaway Chinese soup, they're about 6 or 8 inches tall. I take that container, and there's no holes in the bottom, and I put 2 holes in the side of the container about an inch up. So if you were to fill it with water, you would have about an inch of standing water at the bottom of the pot. And then I plant the orchids in an inorganic substrate called LECA, a lightweight expanded clay aggregate. Some people call it a hydroton. It's a hydroponic growing substrate that you can get at indoor growing supply stores. And so I pot them in that medium, in the semi-hydroponic nature, because it's a very forgiving way. You can water it every day, and you can never overwater it, and I tend to like to water. Or if you forget to water for a few days, it will also hold a reservoir of water that will keep being wicked up by that medium and keep the roots, keep moisture available, but it will never overwater because it's very free-draining.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We will talk more orchids in just a moment with Chris Curry, Iowa State University Associate Professor of Horticulture. Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, is also here, and they'll also answer your questions about orchids or anything. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're talking orchids right now. And you're welcome to join the conversation with your orchid questions or questions about any of the plants in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran, and Chris Curry is also here, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And Chris, we do have an orchid question from Dwayne in Walford. Can I attach my orchid to my Norfolk pine using twine and moss?
Well, you may be able to attach it to your Norfolk pine with twine and moss, but think about where it's going to grow after that. And most Norfolk Island pines that are grown in the home end up having a fairly modest diameter trunk, not that large. And so you may be able to attach it on there, but there's not a whole lot of trunk space or area on that trunk for the roots to really grow and grab hold over a long time. So I think we can just maybe decorate your Norfolk Island pine like a Christmas tree. I would maybe put it on a cork slab, and this is a very common supply that you can find at orchid stores, but mount it on that slab, and then you could maybe mount that slab and hang it on the trunk or hang it off of a branch. So you can get an epiphyte feel while not actually putting it on the trunk. I think that might be a little bit more better recipe for success.
Why do you think you would want to put it on the trunk? What do you see as the benefit there?
Because it looks pretty cool.
Okay.
And this is something that you can often see, especially in more permanent installations like at botanical gardens. And it really is pretty striking because I think when people first see an epiphytic plant, it's pretty crazy and they think it's parasitic and it's taking nutrients. So it's a great conversation piece. but they are harder to maintain when you have mounts, whether it's mounted on a trunk or mounted on a wall. Again, you have to think like what that orchid would like to have for an environment, and when you have the roots exposed like that, it needs more frequent misting or irrigation.
All right. And let's go to the phones. We're going to shift gears just a little bit and talk about roses for a moment. Rusty's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Rusty.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I thought what better to call the experts. It's about roses, but I know they're pretty common. I've been told so many different things since I've moved back to Iowa about how to get them to grow. And I planted some climbing, some stem roses. What it comes down to is in the winter, I've been told to prune them prior to the winter. Then some people tell me no, wait until after the winter. Some people say cover them with styrofoam bins. Some people say cover them with leaves. How do I get them to grow? I know that's kind of a general question, but last summer when they came back, I did prune them right after the winter, and goodness, very few of them grew, where I had them beautiful when I first planted them. So what is the best way to handle this?
So if you're dealing with like a shrub rose, like a Floribunda hybrid tea, whatever, we would typically go out around Thanksgiving, and we would take soil and basically cover maybe the bottom 8 to 10 inches of the rose canes so that the bottom of the plant at least survives. We don't have to save the entire plant, okay? We want to make sure the plant survives, though. And so we cover the bottom 8 to 10 inches with soil. We could put some leaves on top of that, and that should be sufficient. We do not prune them typically in the fall. We recommend pruning them in early spring. And basically in early spring, like in early April, you would remove the soil and then basically prune out the dead wood. And the dead wood is easy to spot because it's basically brown and the live tissue will be green. So you basically prune out the dead wood. Now, if we have a mild winter, there's very little dieback, you might prune the plants back to, let's say, about a foot, foot and a half, and that's fine too. The rose cones, they're very convenient, but they're actually not very effective. They really don't provide much protection. So we kind of discard those as far as a overwintering method. As far as the climbing roses in Iowa, many of those don't do very well because they're not very hardy, and many of these bloom on the previous year's growth. And so if they die back a lot, they don't have any wood to bloom on. So many of those don't do very well. There are a few varieties that I would kind of describe as more of a large shrub that can be used as a climbing rose that are very, very hardy. For example, William Baffin is a very, very hardy tall shrub rose that you can grow as a climbing rose. It has a deep pink flower. It grows into Canada and does very, very well. So there's a number of these varieties that do extremely well that really don't need protection at all.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Rusty, and welcome to Iowa.
Thank you much. Bye-bye.
Bye. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have this orchid comment from Earl in Grinnell. He says, my favorite is the vanilla orchid. Now, of course, a lot of us interact with the vanilla orchid, but he says, not the bloom, but the fermented flower bud. Yum. Chris, are you an orchid eater?
Well, that's another thing that I like to say. Other fun trivia, I ask people, well, have you ever eaten an orchid? And almost everyone says, oh, I've never eaten an orchid. But vanilla ice cream is probably one of the most ubiquitous foods we've ever had. And so I say, well, then you've had an orchid before because that's where we get that flavor from. So it's a pretty unique process. And the reason why it can cost so much is that the orchid, the vanilla flower itself is very, very ephemeral. It only lasts 1 or 2 days. And what we're harvesting is that seed pod that results from pollination. And so most of the commercial orchid vanilla varieties come from Mexico, even though some of the biggest production is going to be in Madagascar. But what happened is until they figured out that they needed to be manually pollinated, it was very difficult to get those seed pods. But once they figured out that it was, if you could manually pollinate it, that's what gave birth to the vanilla industry. So now they're grown pretty much like hedges, and people will walk these hedges every single day finding that flower and pollinating it before it falls off and senesces. So that's why it costs quite a bit to get those orchid pods for your cooking.
Right. Well, and it seems like the price is rising.
That's because there's some challenges right now with the with production. So output is diminishing right now. So that's why you're seeing that increased price tag as well. There's lots of synthetic vanilla scents or flavors. Colleagues over in food science would know more about that. the production of the true vanilla pods is decreasing due to a number of factors.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions. We have Jane on the line in Indianola. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering why so many sycamore trees have kept their leaves from last year.
It's basically weather-related. I wouldn't worry about it. I've noticed that, too. But they've been gradually losing their leaves over the last few weeks. So it's weather-related. I wouldn't worry about it. The tree's fine.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Jane. So we haven't had a lot of heavy snow. We haven't had so far many ice storms. I mean, leaves hanging around on trees can be a little risky this time of year, Richard.
Yeah, but the sycamores that have retained a few, it's just a few. It's a small percentage. And unless we get a really bad ice storm, I think they're going to basically be fine. And they are still falling off periodically during the strong winds. So I think they're fine.
All right. And Chris, let's return to orchids. So if you're looking for something beyond that Phalaenopsis orchid, the one that we see most of the time at the grocery store, at the garden center, where would you go next if you want to broaden your orchid horizons?
Well, first, always start with your local greenhouse and garden center because they may be able to get some orchids in. They might have some in stock already, especially, during the winter as seasonal plants. They'll bring those in the winter when, we may not be selling as many annuals and perennials. But there's also quite a robust nursery trade online for mail order orchids. So you can really find lots and lots and lots of different orchids. It's just a matter of what you're interested in. And I usually say, where are you going to grow it and what kind of light are you going to have? If you're going to have low light, then I suggest something like the tropical lady slipper, the Paphiopedilum. That does well in low light. Alternatively, if you're going to have higher amounts of light, then you could grow things like Oncidiums or Dancing Ladies or the Cattleya orchid, which, interestingly, I think when I talk to students and say orchid, they think moth orchid. But when I talk to my dear Grandma Luz, 93 years old, and I say orchid, she thinks of the Cattleya because that was the corsage orchid. So each generation kind of has their own because, the Cattleya was the popular cut flower orchid. It wasn't much of a potted crop back then, whereas now the Phalaenopsis has been popularized as a houseplant.
Right, which just reminds us that their fashion has something to do with what we grow.
Absolutely.
As well. So tell me about, do you have orchids at home? I mean, you talked about having the orchids in the greenhouse. Do you also have an orchid set up at home?
I am embarrassed to say this. I think we have one houseplant in our house. And that's because we're chasing around our 2.5-year-old twins all the time. But it's more so because I'm spoiled in that once I've seen how I can grow orchids in my greenhouses at school, it's just a little underwhelming at home. But
sure,
that's a bit of an exception to the rule because I know most people don't have a greenhouse where they can cultivate plants. So I used to be the guy. I remember when we moved to Iowa, driving from Indiana, where we were living, going to school, to Iowa, the entire back of the car was filled with plants, and they were all orchids. And I just kept on thinking, like, oh, what would the officer think if he pulls me over? This is going to look weird.
So if you're going to grow orchids at home, what kind of setup do you recommend for people?
Well, you don't necessarily need as much specialized care as you would think. It's really just a lot of maintaining the appropriate light conditions for the plant, maintaining the appropriate temperatures from the plant, and then appropriately watering it. And that may seem like a lot of responsibility, but it can be actually pretty easy. There is one commercial orchid that you see, and they're branded by just using ice cubes to water the plant, where it says put 2 ice cubes a week on the plant. And it sounds kind of gimmicky, and at first I thought it was as well, because these are tropical plants and you're setting ice on the roots. But then you see, I saw a wonderful study done by some colleagues at Ohio State University in Georgia, and they actually measured the internal root temperature when you place the ice cube on. And sure enough, it dipped down to almost freezing, but then it warmed back up and it did not damage the roots at all. So for some of these Phalaenopsis plants, you can just set a couple of ice cubes on the pot every week. I personally, because I like to flush out salts, when I was growing in the home, I tended to take my plants over the sink and irrigate thoroughly and get a lot of leaching just so you don't have salt building up, because salt buildup is one of the things that can kill your orchids because they can be sensitive to too much fertilizer in the root zone. So I'd water it, let it drain, come back a few minutes, and then water it again thoroughly.
Do you avoid using softened water?
It depends, again, on the species, because I used to grow, again, lady slippers. Tropical lady slippers are my specialty, and many of them are lithophytes, and they come from these limestone cliffs. So they like higher levels of calcium and magnesium. So I'd use some of that tap water, but softened water, where it's running through a softener, that sodium, that could absolutely damage it. So it depends. City water can be okay. That softened water, you might want to be careful of that sodium. But another thing you can do is just irrigate thoroughly, so you're trying to wash out any salt from building up. So it might have a little bit more salt in the water than you'd like, but just irrigate thoroughly so the salt isn't building up.
All right, we have an email from Cindy near Ames. She says, please explain why digging up and stealing wild orchids in Iowa is very bad for the orchids as well as being illegal. So we were talking about those early explorers and people finding orchids in the wild, but that's not recommended.
No, orchids, especially out in the wild, they're often established. Well, first of all, because it's illegal, you should not do it. So we want to try and maintain these populations so people can see these things in the wild. But they can be very sensitive to transplanting, and they often don't transplant well. It's a much, much, much better idea for you to purchase, if you want to grow orchids in your garden, to purchase these orchids that are grown in container like traditional perennials, because one, not only is it legal and also more ethical, but you're also going to be more successful as a homeowner by getting one of these lab propagated and greenhouse and nursery grown plants than you are going into your local woods and digging one up. There are also some relationships, these relationships with mycorrhizae in the soil, where they provide more nutrients to the orchid, and then they take some carbohydrates from the orchid, and that may be difficult to replicate in your home soil where you're going to transplant.
So with your honors students, you were bringing in non-horticulture majors to talk about orchids. What did you want them to take away from the experience?
In a way, it was just to, I guess the bottom line is just to be passionate about something. That's one of the things, and I think I like to share that passion, but it's also just to show you how much you can learn from a single plant. You know, I didn't take as many world history courses as I probably should have, and so I've actually used orchids and looking at the history of them and the etymology of nomenclature to learn, say, like Greek mythology. So it's just looking at a plant and just seeing how much more you can learn from it, because there are all sorts of different stories. Again, whether it's Greek mythology and the names, or whether it's the history of the Victorian plant hunters, or whether it's plant science and plant physiology, they're just cool.
Well, in so much of what we do, we scratch the surface of anything. And once you dig a little bit deeper, there are so many stories to be told.
Yeah, and I think that was what was pretty fun, because people said, like, oh, I had no idea. You know, they had no idea that all this existed, or that, they're a great platform for learning, because you can talk about so many different things.
All right. Well, Chris Curry, thank you so much for sharing your obsession with us today.
Absolutely.
Chris Curry, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Richard Giron, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. And we can even start thinking about starting seeds pretty soon, right? There's hope on the horizon.
Pretty soon, yes.
Oh, looks like we already lost Richard before I asked that question, but I'll talk to him about it in 2 weeks on Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The show is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Caitlin Harrop, and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Lulu Dewey and technical support from Nick Brinks. You can get in touch with us anytime. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a good weekend. This is Talk of Iowa.